Welcome to Oncology Nursing Update, Understanding and Caring for Patients with Non-Melanoma Skin Cancers. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Nikhil Kushalani from the Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida, to discuss this exciting topic. To begin, I asked Dr. Kushalani to provide an overview of non-melanoma skin cancers.
Non-melanoma skin cancers actually are exceedingly common, and the two most common ones that we typically see are basal cell carcinoma and cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. And given their cell of origin within the squamous area of the skin, or the keratinocytes, the two of these together are typically called keratinocytic carcinomas. And both of them are typically seen in an older patient population. I think that's very important from a practical standpoint, because we have to consider their comorbidities when we start making treatment decisions for these patients. If you simply look at the United States, for example, in terms of our population, we had over 50 million citizens of the U.S. who are greater than 65 years of age back in 2019. And this number continues to rise, which essentially tells us that the incidence for squamous cell carcinoma and basal cell carcinoma will also increase. And again, putting it very simply, you know, one in five Americans will be diagnosed with a skin cancer in their lifetime. Now, because how common these diseases are, it's almost impossible to put them into a tumor registry like we typically do for other cancers. So we don't have a prospective registry of the number of new cases. So we have to estimate cases based on retrospective data, in other words, like claims databases. And again, just to give you a sense, there were over 5 million cases that were treated back in 2012 based on claims data. And a lot of this is in the Medicare population. So again, very, very common problems. Both of them very strongly related to sunlight and ultraviolet light damage, and typically chronic damage over a period of time rather than the acute damage that we sometimes see more commonly with melanoma. These typically occur more commonly on the head and neck area, as well as sort of the upper shoulders, upper arms, essentially the sun-exposed parts of the body. But important to recognize that the vast majority of them tend to be small, tend to be addressed by the dermatologist or the primary care physician with surgery alone, and the vast majority of them can do very well. In addition to UV radiation, I wanted to point out a couple of other important etiologic factors, including tanning bed use. Immunosuppression is a big one, particularly patients with solid organ transplants and cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, with the number of transplants, particularly kidney transplants, continuing to go up in the U.S. This disease is 100 times more common in transplant recipients compared to non-transplant recipients. Patients with chronic lymphocytic leukemia or other hematologic malignancies who are immunosuppressed are also at higher risk. And then, of course, you have the rarer environmental ionizing radiation chemicals, chronic ulcers or chronic inflammation, and then the very rare genetic subtypes that may be related to, for example, xeroderma pigmentosum or epidermolysis bullosa.
So we're going to kind of focus on the oncology point of view here on patients who actually end up making it to an oncology situation, to a cancer center, et cetera. What kinds of patients, and I want to talk with you a little bit about the interdisciplinary team that is hopefully going to be available to them at tertiary centers for more complicated cases. But what are the kinds of stages of the disease and clinical scenarios that you see in a cancer center, in an oncology setting with these cancers?
Certainly. Again, we see a large number of these patients here at the Moffitt Cancer Center, and I think we're very fortunate that we have a true multidisciplinary evaluation for these patients. A lot of them who come to me as a medical oncologist tend to either already have what we refer to as locally advanced disease, so they've seen a surgeon prior, or are seeing the surgeon simultaneously and it's just too extensive for an operation, or maybe at a part of the head and neck area that would be an exquisite anatomic site where surgery would actually leave them with notable morbidity. So they see us simultaneously, and we are also very fortunate to have radiation oncology specifically for cutaneous cancers here on site with Dr. Wuthrick as well. So I think the surgeon, the radiation oncologist, and the medical oncologist sort of form the three spokes on the therapeutic side. But what's really important in the management of these patients is nursing teams, our advanced practitioners who see these patients for toxicity assessments during their treatment. And then I think what's also really important is social workers, because many of these patients come to us with such neglected tumors over a period of time that there's undoubtedly some element of psychosocial aspect that had led to neglect of that tumor, whatever that that may have been, or even a financial aspect. And so I think involving our social worker as part of that multi-D team is important. And then finally, the dermatologist, because these patients who have one skin cancer have a noticeably higher risk of developing newer skin cancers. So making sure that they have adequate surveillance as time goes by is very important too.
So I'd like to hear a little bit more about what the various members of the Interdisciplinary Pain team do, particularly the radiation oncologist, but also in terms of whatever surgery or surgeon that might be involved. But can you just, before we get into that, comment a little bit more about this issue of people who present because they've been delayed in seeking care for different reasons? Can you talk about the spectrum of what you see, why people end up getting delayed and have very, very advanced cancers, and how that ties into the way you're going to manage them?
I think that's a great question. I think there are a variety of reasons, of course. As I mentioned right in the beginning, these are tumors that typically arise in an elderly population. The average age typically tends to be in the mid-70s for a lot of these patients. And I think in understanding their social aspect is also important, because once these tumors arise, for example, on a very visible area of the head and neck, and they start growing, often that individual may then not want to step outside of the comfort of their home, you know, possibly related to concern of what will other people say about this, or do I have the means to get to the doctor on a regular basis to get this addressed? Or quite frankly, sometimes it's, oh, no big deal. This is a small area. I'm not that worried about it. I'm already 75. I'm already 78. What is the doctor going to tell me anyway? So I think all of these, and every situation is quite unique, but there is that almost recurring theme that we see is once they start neglecting it, these tumors tend to progress over a period of time. And we tend to see squamous cells obviously have a more rapid kinetics of growth compared to basal cells, but both can be equally disfiguring. And so with that neglect, a lot of these patients come to us at an advanced stage where surgery may no longer be an option. But radiation certainly can work for both of these diseases, and we actively incorporate radiotherapy for a lot of our patients where surgery may not be an option.
So let's get a little bit more into that. In terms of the surgery, I know, you know, dermatologists do a lot of surgery in their offices for the smaller lesions. But once you get into these larger, locally advanced lesions, what type of surgeon actually is going to operate on them, and what kind of surgeon do you have in your interdisciplinary clinic?
Great question. Again, we have both surgical oncologists and we have plastic surgeons, and we have our head and neck surgeons. So the plastic surgeons are integral to our cutaneous oncology department. So for example, when I'm in clinic, I have the luxury of having a surgical oncologist, a plastic surgeon, and a radiation oncologist all in the same floor seeing patients simultaneously. And almost every week that we see patients together, there would be a patient from them who would then be referred to me and I would see them on the same day, or vice versa. So I think there's no delay in terms of going back and forth between these subspecialists. Our head and neck surgeons are a different department, but I think after seeing a lot of the data that has come out in the last 5 years for both of these diseases, what we are seeing is actually seeing some of these patients that traditionally would have undergone fairly morbid surgery actually coming to us sooner and getting upfront systemic therapy, which may potentially reduce the extent of an operation that may be required.
Anything new in terms of surgical techniques that you observe as a medical oncologist, advances in surgery, you know, different other parts of surgery, you see robotic surgery, anything new and exciting going on in terms of surgery for these type of cancers?
Well, I think the one thing that immediately comes to mind is the question is whether all of these patients, particularly if they have nodal disease, do they require completion lymph node dissection or not, or can we minimize the extent of surgery that would be performed for these patients? There is data now using immunotherapy for locally advanced or nodal metastatic cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, where we've actually been able to de-escalate because the treatment works so well that they don't need surgery or they don't need radiation therapy. In terms of the specifics of technique, certainly that's not my area of expertise, and I'd have to defer to the surgeons in terms of what is new among what they can do. Most of these patients, I'm not aware of any specific newer surgical techniques that these patients require, at least to render them NED.
What about radiation therapy for these tumors? How sensitive are they to radiation compared to other tumors? And where are they, radiation oncologists typically get involved? What kind of situations?
So radiation is an integral part of management of skin cancers, particularly the keratinocytic carcinomas, such as basal and squamous cell, and certainly for Merkel cell, which is exquisitely sensitive. When one looks at basal cell carcinoma, it is sensitive to radiation, and often radiation can be definitive management without the need for systemic therapy. Again, it all depends on the location and what the, should I use the term, collateral damage may be. For example, one could have a basal cell carcinoma locally advanced of the eyelid. And while it would respond very well to radiotherapy, our radiation oncologists have to take a lot of precautions with, for example, a lead contact lens to prevent radiation to the lens and prevent early cataracts from occurring. So there are a lot of nuances to what they can do, or sometimes even very superficial tumors, but in an exquisite location may benefit from electron beam radiotherapy, which would be better to tolerate. Now, sometimes we would use that in conjunction with systemic therapy, and we've done several of those, particularly when patients have perineural involvement of some of the cranial nerves, and that's important to, you know, optimize local control for those patients. Stereotactic radiation is a critical part. And then I think in cutaneous squamous cell and Merkel cell, post-operative radiation for select high-risk patients in an adjuvant manner becomes very important to optimize local and regional control.
So let's talk about the medical oncologist and systemic therapy. And of course, I think the big advance that's occurred has been the use of immunotherapy, checkpoint inhibitors, anti-PD-1 agents. Can you talk about what we've learned in terms of how sensitive these tumors are to this type of therapy and when it's being utilized?
Certainly. So I'll sort of take one step back. What's really important, you know, talking about when we started this discussion is many of these tumors are related to sun damage. And with UV light damage, there's recurrent damage to the cell DNA and eventually the tumor cell DNA. And that in turn leads to what is referred to as a high tumor mutational burden. And this can now be measured through next-generation sequencing. Most of these platforms that we now have available for tumor sequencing will often tell us what the tumor mutational burden is. And just from a lay perspective, a high tumor mutational burden typically portends or suggests a higher response rate to immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy, specifically anti-PD-1 therapy. As all of us know, anti-PD-1 drugs are now almost ubiquitous in cancers across the board, but the revolution really started in skin cancer, specifically with melanoma, and then was extended to the others as well. So we now have approved immune checkpoint blockade drugs, both for cutaneous squamous cell, for basal cell, and for Merkel cell. In cutaneous squamous cell, we now have 3 FDA-approved agents for the frontline setting for patients who are not candidates for additional radiation or additional systemic immunotherapy. These drugs can work very well, and they have essentially supplanted chemotherapy, for example, in cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. That's what we used to commonly use previously. And now, unless there is an obvious contraindication to immunotherapy, immune checkpoint blockade with either cemiplimab or pembrolizumab or cosibelimab should be our frontline therapy for locally advanced unresectable cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. On the other hand, in basal cell, again, going back, it is a high tumor mutational burden disease, but it is also very typically characterized by abnormalities in what's referred to as the hedgehog pathway. And with patch 1 mutations or SMO mutations, so activation of that pathway is critical for the development of basal cell. And we are fortunate that we have two approved oral drugs that can target that pathway and cause reversal of the cell multiplication that occurs. So we have targeted drugs, and we also have cemiplimab as an approved immunotherapy for patients who are either intolerant to hedgehog inhibitors or are not candidates for it or have had disease progression. And then finally, in Merkel cell, upfront anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-L1 therapy is standard of care.
What about in the adjuvant setting after surgery? Where do checkpoint inhibitors fit in?
So of these, the only one that is now FDA approved is in high-risk adjuvant therapy for cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. And this was based on the results of a large randomized trial called the CPOST study, CPOST standing for cemiplimab in post-operative skin cancer therapy. And this was over 400 patients where they already had their surgery done. They met high-risk criteria, very stringent definitions, but the most common definition was they had to have a lymph node that was at least 2 centimeters or larger that was involved with metastatic cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, and there had to be evidence of extracapsular extension. And of course, there were certain other non-nodal criteria as well that were part of that high-risk definition. Or they had to have at least 3 involved lymph nodes. Those patients meeting these criteria, the patients who received adjuvant cemiplimab, which is an anti-PD-1 agent, after completion of radiation, the cemiplimab was given for up to 1 year of therapy versus placebo on the other arm. Those patients receiving adjuvant cemiplimab had a significantly superior disease-free survival compared to those receiving placebo. And that was a 68% risk reduction, which is quite remarkable because that's the first drug that has been demonstrated in the adjuvant setting to improve outcomes. And so that led the FDA to approve cemiplimab for high-risk resected CSCC in late 2025. And so that is now considered standard of care for these patients to improve outcomes.
And I guess it's worth putting that in context in terms of other trials in the adjuvant setting in terms of how much adjuvantly, you don't have anything to look at. So you're treating based on the risk of the patient. And as you're saying here, the risk of recurrence gets reduced by about 2/3. So the chance of having a recurrent disease, more than half of it is eliminated by having treated with cemiplimab. You know, what we've seen, and there are a bunch of different PD-1 and PD-L1 agents out there. A lot of people, it's kind of hard to separate it out in terms of how they work, what kind of effects they have, side effects. They all look pretty similar. It looks like a lot of times what happened is whatever PD-1 inhibitor is used in a trial that where it works, that's the one that people use. So, I mean, theoretically, you could make the argument, well, maybe another checkpoint inhibitor would have worked as well as cemiplimab, but that wasn't what was used in the study. Is that, and of course, that led to just that one being approved, not the other one. So in general, if you're going to use adjuvant therapy, is cemiplimab what you're going to use? And when you start cemiplimab, whether it's in the adjuvant setting or not, what are some of the things that you go through with the patient in terms of potential tolerability or toxicity issues?
Sure. So since we're on the topic of cemiplimab, as you point out, it can be used for locally advanced, unresectable, or metastatic disease, but it's the only one that's also approved in the adjuvant setting. And I think that's where it's important from a patient education or nursing education standpoint is what are our goals of treatment? And obviously, in the adjuvant setting, our goals of treatment remain curative in intent. In the advanced setting, our goals of treatment typically are prolongation of disease control. But what we actually see is some of these patients, even in the advanced setting, up to 20% of patients can have a complete response to anti-PD-1 therapy. And many of them, their duration of response can be many, many months or sometimes even several years. And I have many patients in my practice who are out 5 years from the start of immunotherapy and are doing remarkably well. But in the adjuvant setting, you're absolutely right. I think it becomes even more of an important discussion when we discuss the pros and cons of adjuvant therapy because of the potential for toxicity. And while many of these toxicities can be fairly straightforward, including fatigue, rash, diarrhea, pruritus, and usually you stop the drug, you can treat them symptomatically depending on the severity of toxicity. And some patients may require steroids and other biologics, but though that's fairly uncommon with monotherapy. The key issue in my mind in this adjuvant setting also becomes, how does this impact for chronic toxicity? For example, endocrine toxicity that we see. About 12% of patients on adjuvant cemiplimab developed hypothyroidism. And while it's easy enough for us to say, well, you could just take an extra pill like levothyroxine or equivalent to manage hypothyroidism, again, I caution people that these are patients in their 70s. And in fact, some in their 80s as well. So I think we have to look at the patient, discuss the pros and cons with them, and then make some decisions. There's the rare toxicity of adrenal insufficiency. Again, single-digit percentages, but that is a life-altering toxicity that can develop with these agents.
And of course, again, as you mentioned, we've had checkpoint inhibitors out there for a while, so people, I think, are aware that these are autoimmune toxicities, which is not surprising. You're stimulating the immune system. What about contraindications to using checkpoint inhibitors? The two that people talk about is one, prior autoimmune disease that might get ramped up if you give them immunotherapy, and the other is a solid organ transplant, kidney transplant, heart transplant, et cetera. What about patients in those situations? Do you ever use checkpoint inhibitors?
So I'll start with the latter question first. For solid organ transplant recipients, I have used checkpoint inhibitors for those patients, but only in the locally advanced or metastatic setting where the disease was equally bad. And so untreated disease or disease that may have already progressed on chemotherapy or anti-EGFR therapy, and you're really left with no other options, I think that becomes a real shared decision-making process with the patient. There is now prospective data in CSCC in kidney transplant recipients. And this was from the group in Boston where what they did was give high-dose pulse steroids at the time the checkpoint inhibitor was being used and then rapidly drop the dose after 4 days of use and then continue 10 milligrams of prednisone during that three-week cycle and then repeated the same course. Again, small population of kidney transplant patients, 12 to my recollection, and none of them had evidence of kidney or allograft failure. And so I've done something similar. I've done that. I've extended that to others, including liver transplant and heart transplant patients as well. But this really needs to be a shared decision-making because patients have to understand what the true risk is. I think it also calls for very close collaboration with the transplant team. So I will always call the kidney transplant doctor or the heart transplant doctor and make sure that they're comfortable with that so that if there is any problem, you know, we can immediately rely on their resources to help manage the rejection. In terms of the other question on autoimmunity, we do use these drugs in patients with autoimmune disorders, but I think those are all decided on a case-by-case basis. If one specifically looks at the original eligibility criteria that led to these drugs getting approved, autoimmune disorders that required prior therapy was an automatic exclusion. But since then, we've got real-world data that suggests that, yes, patients can be safely managed. For example, if I have a patient with rheumatoid arthritis or a patient with lupus, as long as they're not getting biologic therapy for those disorders, I am quite comfortable managing them. I think if they've had their last flare or exacerbation of the autoimmune toxicity in the remote past and has been very quiescent, I think we can safely use these disorders. But patient communication becomes important. It has to be two-way. And they have to recognize that as soon as they develop any flare or side effect, they need to call us right away so we can initiate mitigation.
So kind of going back to the way these agents work and how effective checkpoint inhibitors are, one thing I kind of wonder about is what do we know about PD-1 levels in these patients? You mentioned TMB, which is a lot of times is high. You know, in lung cancer, you have people have very high PD-1 levels and they just use immunotherapy. They don't even use chemotherapy. And some of these people are alive at 5 years, even with metastatic disease. You also have MSI-high cancers, for example, MSI colon or rectal cancer. And everybody knows that in rectal cancer. There's just been a study from Memorial where they just used IO in MSI-high patients. They didn't even use chemo. Some of these people aren't even going to surgery because these cancers are so sensitive to immunotherapy. Can you explain a little bit more about why these type? And it seems like, again, these non-melanoma skin cancers kind of fit into that category, being very sensitive. What is it about it? Is there a high PD-1 level? Why are they so responsive?
Well, I think that's still, I don't think we have one clear explanation for why they tend to be so responsive. We do know that because of the high tumor mutational burden, theoretically, there's a noticeably higher number of neoantigens that occurs, and therefore there's greater potential in, again, very simple terminology, for the immune system to recognize these neoantigens once the blockade or the immune checkpoint blockade has been reversed by the utilization of these drugs. The question you ask about PD-1 levels or by immunohistochemistry at the tumor level or even in the tumor microenvironment has been investigated on serial biopsies for these patients, both with basal cell as well as cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. And what is important is to understand is that while tumors with high PD-1 levels, PD-L1 levels, we call it a composite score as well, by immunohistochemistry, they have a higher likelihood of response, so the response rates are higher. But it's really important to note that even those that are negative for that or low PD-L1, less than 1%, still respond. So I don't use that as a discrimination factor. Even those that are low, we will still offer them anti-PD-1 therapy. And so we routinely don't test it at all in skin cancers because it often does not help us make that decision whether or not to use an immune checkpoint blocker in those patients.
As I was mentioning, in lung cancer with high PD-1 levels, you're seeing patients who in the past, had, very limited lifespan, who are getting out to 5 years. People are talking about cure. Now, this is not the majority of patients, but maybe 20-25% of patients. What about a non-melanoma skin cancer, metastatic disease? In general, what's the usual prognosis? What's the likelihood of surviving 5 years? And then what about with checkpoint inhibitors? Is there a so-called tail on the curve?
Great question. So again, going back to historical data, if one looked at what we did for CSCC in the past with chemotherapy up front or even chemotherapy and EGFR-based inhibition, typically the median survivals for those patients was under 1 year. But when you now look at long-term follow-up data from Empower, which was the trial that led to cemiplimab approval, or from the Keynote study that led to approval of pembrolizumab, we actually have longer-term data for those patients as well. And the duration of response for responding patients comfortably exceeds 18 months or longer, and most of the patients who have experienced a response maintain that response. So we now have follow-up data for these patients that demonstrate excellent survivals, and despite not requiring continuation of their therapy, most of these patients will stop their treatment at about 1 year, 1.5 years. In some cases, we will continue for up to 2 years, but it's rare that we would go beyond 2 years of systemic therapy. So from our standpoint, these patients, we can, comfortably continue management of these patients, and they can actually go back and lead very, very normal lives. Yeah. Going back to the question that you asked about tail of the curve, a lot of these tails of that curve are fairly flat. Even you go back and look at the Empower locally advanced cohort, this was 78 patients with locally advanced CSCC treated with cemiplimab. The response rate was about 45% with 13% complete response rates and remarkably good disease control that continued. And when you combine all three cohorts that were used in the cemiplimab Empower trial, there were two metastatic cohorts, one locally advanced, the median progression-free survival was about 18 months. And this is progression-free survival with overall survival not even reported for those patients. The vast majority of patients do very well once they respond.
Is cure a word you would apply to some of these patients?
I think it's hard to say because I would say durable disease control. That's the way I tend to phrase it for patients. I will tell you that I have started being a little more optimistic about cure in the advanced melanoma setting, where we now have 10-year data for checkpoint inhibition. We haven't reached that yet with cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. So maybe once we have the 8 to 10-year data for follow-up, I would probably start using that word. Typically, we tended to use it for patients at 5 years, and we have many patients who now meet those criteria.
Any correlation between autoimmune toxicity and benefit of treatment? Do people who have more autoimmune problems actually do better in terms of the cancer? Do we know that?
I think we know some information on that. It's not been consistent, and it depends on which study you actually look at. The only one that I have consistently seen predictive of benefit is those patients who develop vitiligo on treatment. So when they develop hypopigmented patches on their skin, regardless of which skin cancer we are treating, those are patients that clearly have a higher likelihood that they will achieve a response, potentially even durable. Studies have variably looked at skin rash or diarrhea or other types of immune toxicities. I don't think that there is any definitive conclusion that can be made from that. And I've had patients who've had absolutely no toxicity at all, but done very well with their treatment.
What are some of the scenarios where you see serious, potentially life-threatening autoimmune toxicities with IOs, and how often do you see that?
Thankfully, first, they're very rare, but the serious ones that we see are myocarditis or the triple M syndrome, which is myositis, myocarditis, myasthenia gravis, and those are under 1%, typically in the range of about 0.5% of time. But again, high index of suspicion and rapid intervention is what those patients require. And thankfully, we don't see that very common. Those are a little more common if you're using combination immune checkpoint blockade. For example, Ipi plus Nivo, like we do in melanoma and other cancers. We don't routinely use Ipi-Nivo for patients with keratinocytic carcinomas. It's not an approved indication, but certainly off-label use does occur. The other toxicity that I think is important to mention, particularly that can be very sudden and with major impacts on quality of life, is the development of autoimmune type 1 diabetes. I mean, these patients can actually present very acutely with symptoms of diabetic ketoacidosis and have very labile glycemic control even when you put them on insulin. And it's a major, major life change. Again, thinking about patients who are elderly, now trying to tell them that you have to be on insulin on a regular basis is extraordinarily difficult. So it's not trivial when we talk to them about the possibility of these toxicities. Encephalitis is another one, but again, thankfully, quite rare.
So you mentioned that another type of systemic therapy that's used, particularly mainly with basal cell, are so-called hedgehog inhibitors. We could probably spend a whole hour just talking about that, but can you just sort of summarize when hedgehog inhibitors are used, how effective they are in these patients, and in particular, what do you see in terms of tolerability issues with these agents? Because that seems to be a significant problem.
That is absolutely correct. So there are two approved hedgehog inhibitors, vismodegib and sonidegib, typically for the management of locally advanced unresectable basal cell carcinoma, which is the vast majority of patients that we in a medical oncology practice would see. It's rare to see metastatic basal cell. That tends to be less than 10% of patients with advanced BCC. And most common sites of metastatic disease tend to be the lung and the bone. For these patients, the pathway, the hedgehog pathway, is what is critical to the development. And normally, again, just in very simple terminology, the patch gene, we call it the PTCH1 gene, the patch gene is what is responsible for keeping SMO or smoothened homolog under control. If there's a mutation in the patch gene or there's a mutation in SMO, smoothened homolog, it takes patch away from allowing it to repress SMO, and therefore SMO gets activated and there are downstream signaling cascade that eventually leads to cellular multiplication or division and development of BCC. So the drugs that we have essentially restore this pathway to normalcy. So they're basically hedgehog inhibitors, and they're given orally once a day. The problem with these drugs, while they are very effective, about 60 to 65% response rate in the locally advanced setting, and some patients have a complete response that can be very durable. The problem is the side effects that are associated with these, because the hedgehog pathway is not simply unique to basal cell carcinoma. It's almost ubiquitous in multiple other organ systems of the body, for example, taste buds or our hair. So dysgeusia, altered taste, hair loss, sometimes alopecia, or that is sometimes irreversible. An interesting side effect is muscle cramps, which can be almost unpredictable, just like severe Charlie horses that can occur in patients, and fatigue. These are sort of the four big side effects. And if you just look at a continuum of patients with basal cell carcinoma that have been treated for 6 to 12 months, virtually 100% of them will develop some degree of toxicity that requires dose interruption for these agents. These agents have a long half-life, and so typically the way they were originally approved was on a daily basis, but practically in my practice, it is rare that patients can continue this indefinitely. And so we often have to come up with some novel ways of interruption of therapy or a scheduled break from treatment, a few couple of weeks on, couple of weeks off. And I think we all do that, just trying to understand how comfortable we are in terms of management of those patients. But that is their key limitation, is the side effects that do not allow it to continue indefinitely.
Yeah, I've heard stories about, you know, people wanting to stop the drug for the holidays so they could eat or eat more happily. But how long does it take from the time you stop the agent? You mentioned it has a long half-life before the sort of the symptoms go away.
So I think the number one is alopecia may be irreversible. It may come back, but many patients it may be irreversible. The ones that do indeed get better are the altered taste, but that takes anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks to get better, because it essentially requires regeneration of the papillae on the taste buds, essentially, from that standpoint. And so you're absolutely right. I think quality of life is very important. So I know if I know a patient is doing well on these drugs and wants time off during Thanksgiving and Christmas, by all means, I will give them that time off. And again, that becomes a shared decision with the patient. There are some patients who are very nervous about stopping treatment at all. So we may come up with a more modified schedule, like a week on, a week off. And I think that may allow the patient to continue therapy. Many patients describe what they call a cardboard tasting sensation when they try to eat. So they almost lose that sensation of taste, or they start noticing that food is tasting very salty or on the contrary, very sweet, depending on what has changed in their taste buds. And so the downstream effect of that, unfortunately, is weight loss. And so we often have to, again, counsel patients in terms of supplements, in terms of checking your weight on a weekly basis and making sure they don't go down that pathway. And that's where our nursing teams become really important in helping patients and encouraging patients with their follow-up and all of these simple associate measures to deal with toxicities.
How do you integrate checkpoint inhibitors along with these hedgehog inhibitors in the management of patients with basal cell? Like, which comes first, or how do you do that?
So the traditional approach has been upfront hedgehog inhibition, unless a patient absolutely said, there is no way I'm going to do that. And I have had some patients who are who travel, who have to essentially, a lot of what they do is, and their outward appearance, and therefore they cannot take the risk for alopecia because they're working in an environment where appearances are important in interaction with additional professional colleagues. And those are patients that are willing to, you know, get immune checkpoint inhibition once every 3 weeks. And I've certainly utilized that in the frontline setting as well. But I would say the typical approach tends to be upfront hedgehog inhibition. And then if patients are intolerant to it or progress, then moving over to cemiplimab as their second line treatment. That being said, there is data now that is emerging, for example, from the group at Johns Hopkins, where they have used in a clinical trial upfront PD-1 inhibition with nivolumab and shown response rates as high as 50% for those patients. So obviously a randomized trial will eventually be required in terms of sequencing, but whether that would eventually occur is almost anybody's guess.
So I want to hear a little bit about your cases, but one question first, which is, Where do you see things heading in terms of new developments, new research trials in this setting? Where do you think we'll be in 2 or 3 years? What are some of the things that are being looked at right now in clinical trials?
Great question. So I'll deal with that as two separate diseases. If one looks at CSCC, I think certainly trying to see, are there other checkpoint inhibitors, given that this is a disease that is uniquely sensitive to immune checkpoint blockade? Could we combine checkpoint inhibitors, and then could we combine them with anti-EGFR inhibitors? So that's an active area of investigation. For example, the iTackle study, where patients receive pembrolizumab upfront for locally advanced or metastatic CSCC, and if they progressed, then they continued pembrolizumab but added cetuximab to that and found that there was a response to the combination. Of course, one could ask the question is, do you really need the checkpoint inhibitor to continue in that second-line setting or not? And that, I think, in itself is a research question. Or combining these with chemotherapy like we've done in lung cancer. Those would be additional approaches that one would take for CSCC. To me, the most exciting thing, at least recently in CSCC, has almost been using the efficacy of these drugs to de-escalate the regional therapy. And this was very elegantly shown in a small trial from Australia called the DSQUAM-8 study, where about 65% of patients treated with upfront immunotherapy no longer required surgery or radiation or its combination. And I think, again, going back to this is an older patient population, if less is more for them, I would take that every single day. And so I think trying to really understand how we can do better with maybe less toxicity is really important. If one switches over to sort of the basal cell aspect, I think there are, given that this is a disease that is, again, manifest with the potential to impede the hedgehog pathway, obviously looking at some more novel hedgehog inhibitors would be important. For example, you know, novel agents that target SMO like taletrectinib, then GLI inhibitor, GLI inhibitors that sort of try to bypass these mutations downstream. Those are currently being investigated as well. There has been some interest in combining hedgehog inhibition with immunotherapy, but that really didn't bear much fruit and didn't add or didn't synergize in terms of increased efficacy. And I think another novel area of approach, given that, particularly for basal cell, given that this is all on the skin for the vast majority, topical hedgehog inhibition is also being investigated.
What about intralesional therapy? Is that done at all?
The answer is yes. So intralesional therapy has actually been done for a long time for both of these, but more so for cutaneous squamous cell, including, for example, intralesional methotrexate, intralesional fluorouracil, that has been utilized for these patients. There is an ongoing trial that's actually looking at intralesional cemiplimab for patients with early-stage cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma at selected anatomic locations. For example, the head and neck area, the pre-tibial area, those are areas that are harder to operate. And so these patients get intralesional cemiplimab once a week for 6 weeks. And the primary endpoint is to determine the efficacy and safety of that approach. So it's quite possible that if that is a successful trial, that we may have an intralesional immunotherapy approach for these patients as well.
Yeah, I saw that in your CV. I don't remember hearing about intralesional immunotherapy like that before. Has it been done in any other cancer?
Well, we've had in melanoma, we've had oncolytic virotherapy, and we do have an approved agent like T-VEC, but I don't recall specifically intralesional immunotherapy. I mean, the only other place that we have used it, and it's actually part of the NCCN guidelines, is lumbar direct injection into the CSF for leptomeningeal disease. But this is specifically for patients with metastatic melanoma with leptomeningeal involvement. Intrathecal nivolumab through a pilot study at MD Anderson was demonstrated to have efficacy. And so it's now included as part of a consideration as part of the NCCN guidelines as well.
Wow, really amazing. All right, let's hear a little bit about your cases. What about this 70-year-old man? What was your first encounter with him?
So this is a patient who came to us actually after the tumor had already been resected. So this, while it gives you the initial aspect, who had already undergone Mohs surgery, which is what is commonly done for a poorly differentiated squamous cell carcinoma on the right temple, had evidence of perineural invasion, and that increases the risk of local regional relapse, and very appropriately got adjuvant radiotherapy, and then developed metastatic disease to the right parotid, as you can see highlighted here on the CT as well as the PET scan on the bottom right. So this patient then had already undergone a parotidectomy and limited cervical dissection and had 2 of 31 lymph nodes that were involved, and clearly with high-risk features. If you recall the discussion on C-post greater than 2 centimeters with extracapsular extension, this met all of those criteria. And therefore, from the options that are presented at the bottom, you know, in the old days, we may have just considered option number one, adjuvant radiotherapy. But now, with approval of cemiplimab, option four would be very reasonable to offer this patient to reduce his risk of disease relapse.
So what actually happened with the patient?
So he started with treatment. He got his radiation, expected toxicity, and then started cemiplimab. As you know, cemiplimab was only recently approved about 4 months ago. He has developed hypothyroidism, but otherwise actually tolerating treatment very well. And the plan will be to continue 1 year of treatment. I anticipate in the next 2 or 3 years, we'll see a lot more real-world experience using adjuvant cemiplimab, and we will see whether that mirrors the results of the CPOS study.
You know, in other adjuvant situations, particularly in breast cancer, if patients want it, oncologists will give them a risk of relapse, of what the likelihood of relapse is with treatment and without treatment. I don't know whether he asked or was interested in that, but when you look at his case, assuming he got the radiation therapy, as you say, that's been out there for a while, what would you say his chance of relapse would be? And then what do you, if he asked you, what do you think the chance of relapse would be if he took the cemiplimab?
Great question. So I think we don't have great means of clearly telling us what the risk of relapse would be. This is all born out of, I would say, experience and prior literature that's currently available. There are, if one just simply looks at the initial presentation of cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma at the time of primary surgery, there are a variety of risk factors that one takes into account, and the greater the number of risk factors, the higher the likelihood of both local recurrence, nodal mets, distant mets, and disease-specific death. And I tend to call this the 3Ds and perineural invasion. So you have a larger tumor diameter of 2 centimeters, poorly differentiated histology, deep tumors. The tumors, the depth is beyond subcutaneous fat, and then invasion of a large caliber nerve. And these progressively, if you have all of these, let's say you had all of these four risk factors at the time of initial presentation, you know, the risk of nodal metastases, the 5-year incidence is about 28% for those patients. And this has been shown in a variety of retrospective data reviews. And so they now have several online calculators that one could, you know, adopt a personalized risk model for development of poor outcomes in these patients. However, those, again, I caution everyone who utilizes these, this is for the initial presentation. So maybe going back to the time that this patient presented with the tumor on his temple. In this particular situation, after coming to me, I would probably estimate that he probably has about a 30% risk of regional and distant metastases. And potentially, cemiplimab may offer the chance of reducing that by about 2/3.
So maybe going down to 10% or really a 20% chance that by taking the drug is going to avoid relapse, which do you see that people in general are very want to receive the therapy, or they want to see how much benefit it is? I know a lot of people really love the idea of getting immunotherapy. You know, it's such an attractive strategy.
I think in this disease, again, I think it's important to recognize that this is an older population for the most part that we are dealing with. And I think a lot of them are still of the mindset where it's a little bit paternalistic, where they then defer back to you and say, well, what would you recommend? If you tell me I should do it, I'll do it. And I see a lot of that in my advanced skin cancer patients as well. I do tell them, I said, as long as you understand what the risk of side effects are and are willing to do it, we will do this together. This would be a shared journey between you and us. And, you know, we are here to help you through this journey. So I do think that in the right circumstance and right clinical scenario, this is very appropriate. But if the same patient had, say, for example, multiple cardiac comorbidities, had symptomatic congestive heart failure or symptomatic COPD on oxygen, I'm not sure that I would necessarily offer that individual adjuvant therapy. I would discuss it. But then the patient has to understand that some of their underlying disease may, you know, become symptomatic with therapy. These are not trivial drugs.
So I see that this man actually had multiple cancers on, you know, the scalp, the face, and the neck. What kind of sun exposure had he had during his life? And did he have regrets about, you know, not using sunscreen or, you know, whatever?
You know, I think that the standard line that I hear from a lot of these patients is, well, when we were growing up, there was no sunscreen. When we were growing up, there was mainly baby oil, and we would go outside, and we would be outside all the time. And this was an individual who was native to Florida, so obviously lifetime sun exposure. I'm not sure that any of them necessarily have true regrets, because it was the general sort of thought process. That being said, I think it's so important now to educate our younger generation that this is preventable. These are diseases that you don't want to be dealing with 30 years later. So use sunscreen, use sun protective measures, educate, I think is so important, because we know that that could potentially reduce your risk of developing skin cancer.
Well, also, I guess, too, to see the dermatologist if you have a problem. Was there any issue here in his history of having delayed coming in? Was he a patient who kind of followed what you asked him to do?
He was. He absolutely was. And when he had, you know, he had multiple prior early stage skin cancers, and then he had Mohs surgery for this and was in routine follow-up. And then 18 months later is when he developed nodal metastases that was then appropriately addressed.
So one more question in terms of side effects. How challenging was the dry mouth and pruritus after you got him on the antihistamines? Did he feel relatively well? And then when he got the hypothyroidism, was he actually clinically hypothyroid, or you picked it up with blood work?
The hypothyroid is almost always picked up with blood work. I mean, we've seen patients with very high serum TSH levels who are completely asymptomatic outside of saying, well, I'm slightly more tired. Dry mouth, I think, is actually a xerostomia, is an underreported side effect of these drugs. I suspect it occurs because of inflammation of the salivary glands. And even when you go back and look at the original pembrolizumab, nivolumab approvals and their original studies in melanoma, it was rarely reported. But I think we all see it in clinical practice. The pruritus was mild and very easily managed.
So let's hear about your 74-year-old man. Sounds pretty interesting. Multiple basal cells, but then he ends up with squamous cell.
Right. So this is a patient who had multiple BCCs in the head and neck, treated appropriately with surgical resection. Then he noticed an area on his right eye. It was like on his conjunctiva and near the sclera. And he said this has been there for many years and then only recently had started growing. So and at his outside ophthalmology evaluation, they saw pterygium in each eye, but they also saw this plaque-like lesion on the medial aspect of the right conjunctiva, very close to the right medial canthus. And they initially thought, very appropriately, this is what we refer to as an ocular surface squamous neoplasia. It's almost like the equivalent of squamous cell carcinoma in situ of the skin, like Bowen's disease. And so he went to the Eye Institute, was recommended for further evaluation, including the biopsy. But this actually occurred during COVID pandemic. The patient developed COVID, and then the pandemic was ongoing, so his follow-up then got delayed, and unfortunately had a very rapid disease progression, as you saw in the photograph, where almost the tumor had encompassed the entire conjunctiva and the eye. And what you see here are sagittal views on a CT scan that show this large enhancing tumor in the right globe and causing compression and displacement of the eyeball. And this involved the superior rectus muscle and clearly had impacted on his vision. So the only approach here would have been an excenteration, so removal of the globe, removal of the eyeball as well as the attached muscles and tendons versus upfront systemic therapy, and he was referred to me for that. Yeah. So we started him on systemic therapy. He tolerated treatment with anti-PD-1 treatment very well. And what you see on the left side here is dramatic response. You can actually now see normal eye returning. You can still see tumor along the medial aspect. And then a few months later, pretty much all resolved. And he's completed 1 year of treatment, did very well. You see the sagittal view at the bottom on the CT scan. And he's been in follow-up, doing remarkably well. But then interestingly, 6 months after completion of his treatment, he presented with hyponatremia and hypochloremia and fatigue. And sure enough, workup that we did demonstrated adrenal insufficiency, and we've replaced that with hydrocortisone, and he continues to do well.
What type of workup do you do to diagnose adrenal insufficiency? What did you see with him, and how did he feel once you started treatment?
So typically we would do a random cortisol level and ACTH level. In an ideal circumstance, this lab work should be done at 0800 in the morning, just to try and mimic the diurnal pattern of cortisol that we see. Some cases are not as straightforward. His cortisol level was almost negligible, so we knew that this is what it was. He had presented with fatigue, and his labs had shown hyponatremia and hypochloremia, which can be seen in adrenal insufficiency. Many of these patients have non-specific symptoms, you know, some cold intolerance, fatigue, just tiredness, just don't feel very well. And as I tell our trainees, that you just have to have a high index of suspicion at diagnosing this, because any acute illness can put these patients over the top and precipitate a symptomatic adrenal crisis, including a simple surgery can do that as well. Once we started the hydrocortisone replacement, and again, mimicking the diurnal variation, patient felt dramatically improved. These patients respond within 24 to 48 hours, and they feel essentially back to baseline and wonder why, in retrospect, they were feeling so poorly for several weeks to months prior to that.
So this case is a great example of how systemic therapy can really have an effect on the tumors that are not surgically resectable. It kind of reminds me a little bit about neoadjuvant therapy in breast cancer, where you take women with big tumors, you shrink it down, then they can have a lumpectomy. What are some of the kinds of ways people respond like this, and where you see a big difference in being able to approach the patient with local therapy after getting systemic treatment, so either surgery or radiation after? What are the locations and the clinical scenarios where you've seen people really benefit from this sort of neoadjuvant type approach?
So I think this is a classic example. Of course, this patient didn't even require any form of local therapy because of the excellent response that he had. But we see it, for example, in patients with locally advanced tumors of the ear, where they are spared an auriculectomy, or patients with tumors that are very close to the facial nerve that normally would require surgery, and you're able to shrink them, and the surgeon now can clearly identify where the facial nerve is and spare the patient from a postoperative facial palsy. Other tumors on the lower extremities, pre-tibial location, another difficult area for wound healing. And so those are, you know, the areas that I think upfront systemic therapy, either as a neoadjuvant manner, where we have clinical trial data to support that as well, has really, really been beneficial.
All right, let's finish out with your last case. A 71-year-old man, facial sunburn as a teenager. That's interesting. What happened with him?
So he distinctly recalls, particularly on the left side of his face. He says, "I clearly had a bad sunburn when I was a child." He grew up in the New England area. And interestingly, you know, thought nothing of it till at early age, in his 50s, developed an early basal cell carcinoma, literally on the right, on the left cheek. He underwent resection and then had a recurrence at the same site, another surgery, and then a second recurrence. And for that, he underwent six-stage Mohs, you know, to get negative margins. And then he required a cervicofacial flap reconstruction. So he did all right from that standpoint. But then 2 years later, interestingly, he developed left axillary adenopathy. And a biopsy showed basal cell carcinoma. And that certainly is a possibility. It's uncommon, but BCC can spread to lymph nodes, lung, and bone. And they compared this to the prior basal cell carcinoma of the cheek, which also had squamous features. And you can see the classic BER-EP4 immunostain, which is the EpCAM antigen staining, which is quite typical for basal cell carcinoma. A PET scan showed the left axillary multiple areas of adenopathy, and so he undergoes radical excision, left axillary nodal dissection. He had a locally advanced tumor there. There was involvement of the serratus anterior and the latissimus. So he then went on to receive adjuvant radiotherapy again, intent to cure. But then he developed a recurrence again in the axilla because he clearly had high-risk disease with almost infiltrating tumor that had been seen previously. And interestingly, he also had a very slowly growing right middle lung lesion. And that was also resected, turned out to be a focus of metastatic basal cell carcinoma. Again, did well. And then a very slowly enlarging left axillary soft tissue mass. Initially, in the first 4 to 6 months, this was thought to be, you know, post-operative changes from radiation and the prior surgery. But as it continued to grow larger, it was clearly that this was tumor. It was biopsied, confirmed to be recurrent disease. That's when he started oral vismodegib, 150 milligrams a day. And as we discussed earlier, this patient developed all of the typical toxicities that you see with hedgehog inhibition, requiring interruption or dose modification. He had a nice partial response that lasted for almost 3 years, so he was better than the typical median. Median time to progression on vismodegib is about 18 to 24 months. See? And then started developing increasing numbness in the left hands and fingers and plus pain in the axilla. And you can see he clearly has fairly large local recurrence. And so given his progression on vismodegib, I started him on cemiplimab. That was the approved agent, or that is the approved agent. And what you see here serially is at 3 months and then 9 months of cemiplimab, and the bottom left is at 12 months. He's had a very, very nice partial response to treatment. Another patient with dry mouth and arthritis. The arthritis has been a little bit problematic for him, so has required low-dose prednisone now plus hydroxychloroquine. And he's been on cemiplimab now for a little over a year and so far doing well.
Can you talk a little bit more about the arthritis? What joints were involved? Were they actually swollen and red? And have you seen this before with IOs?
We do. It's among the, I would say, the top five common toxicities that we see. And in fact, at least in my clinical practice, I think it's probably one of the more difficult ones to manage, particularly as it lingers on, even long after stopping therapy. And we often will need to seek out a good rheumatologist to assist us with management. In this particular case, his joints were primarily the shoulders, the hips and knees. He did have a little bit of discomfort in the wrist, but not as much. But it was mainly the large joints that were affected. And they respond very dramatically to steroids. But the minute you start trying to taper the steroids down, the symptoms start to recur again. So with the arthritis, I tend to be much slower in my taper. And if it starts recurring, then I often will try a steroid-sparing agent such as hydroxychloroquine, or in selected cases, escalation to other biologic therapy as well.
And he had no history at all of arthritis?
No, not of the autoimmune variant.
Very interesting. So we've kind of about come to the end of our discussion here. Anything else you want to add that we haven't, comments you want to make that we haven't gotten into, you want to add to what we've said today?
Sure. No, I think it's important to recognize that immunotherapy is here to stay for skin cancer, for non-melanoma skin cancers. And it really has, I would say, reshaped the paradigms of management. We're certainly using it in earlier stage disease. We're using it preoperative. We're using it postoperative to reduce the risk of recurrence. And while we do that, it really becomes sort of to the forefront that we have to include patient education, provider education, and make sure that lines of communication between patient and the treatment team are always open so that we can help patients manage toxicities. For the most part, most of these toxicities are anticipated, but some of them, as we mentioned earlier, can become life-threatening. So we can certainly walk with patients through this and help them overcome it. And finally, I think a lot of this is preventable. So sun protection, sunscreen, critical, particularly for our younger generation.
This concludes our program. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes. During the program, the use of agents and treatments that are not approved may have been discussed, so please check out the package inserts for more. Special thanks to Dr. Khushalani, and thank you for tuning in. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Nursing Update, Understanding and Caring for Patients with Non-Melanoma Skin Cancers.